good horse, I call you my shiny black bears. To the playhouse of fortune, to take the bright silver and gold you have taken from somebody else. And as we go right.
You're listening to episode 635 of Unwelcome Guests, Apocalypse Postponed. I'm Robin Upton. And it turns out concerns about the Mayan calendar were unfounded last week. What a relief, eh? This is going to be a sequel to last week's show on zombies and catastrophism. I wish I had the confidence to say we'll call this Apocalypse Cancelled. However, I think humanity is still in a pretty dire situation and it needs some concerned attention to turn things around. Later on in the show, we're going to focus on two ideas which I think are key to this process. Firstly, the question of whether there are too many people on Earth, and we just need a good die-off, need to reduce population, that will improve our situation. And secondly, whether we can use the money system in more or less its current form as a tool to help improve the situation. I think seasoned listeners might well be able to predict my thoughts on those two points, but you won't be hearing those today. This show we have four speakers, all new to the show, all speaking earlier this year. We're going to start with the inspiring Janine Shepherd, who entitled her presentation, A Truth I Know Very Well From My Own Experience with the So-Called Handicapped, A Broken Body Isn't a Broken Person.
Life is about opportunities, creating them and embracing them. And for me, that was the Olympic dream. That's what defined me. That was my bliss. As a cross-country skier and member of the Australian ski team headed towards the Winter Olympics, I was on a training bike ride with my fellow teammates. As we made our way up towards the spectacular Blue Mountains west of Sydney, it was the perfect autumn day. Sunshine, the smell of eucalypt, and a dream. Life was good. We'd been on our bikes for around 5.5 hours when we got to the part of the ride that I loved, and that was the hills, because I loved the hills. And I got up off the seat of my bike and I started pumping my legs. And as I sucked in the cold mountain air, I could feel it burning my lungs. And I looked up to see the sun shining in my face. And then everything went black. Where was I? What was happening? My body was consumed by pain. I'd been hit by a speeding utility truck with only 10 minutes to go on the bike ride. I was airlifted from the scene of the accident by a rescue helicopter to a large spinal unit in Sydney. I had extensive and life-threatening injuries. I'd broken my neck and my back in 6 places. I broke 5 ribs on my left side. I broke my right arm. I broke my collarbone. I broke some bones in my feet. My whole right side was ripped open, filled with gravel. My head was cut open across the front, lifted back, exposing the skull underneath. I had head injuries, I had internal injuries, I had massive blood loss. In fact, I lost about 5 litres of blood, which is all someone my size would actually hold. By the time the helicopter arrived at Prince Henry Hospital in Sydney, my blood pressure was 40 over nothing. I was having a really bad day. For over 10 days, I drifted between 2 dimensions. I had an awareness of being in my body, but also being out of my body, somewhere else, watching from above as if it was happening to someone else. Why would I want to go back to a body that was so broken? But this voice kept calling me, "Come on, stay with me." "No, it's too hard. Come on, this is our opportunity." "No, that body is broken. It can no longer serve me. Come on, stay with me. We can do it. We can do it together." I was at a crossroads. I knew if I didn't return to my body, I'd have to leave this world forever. It was the fight of my life. After 10 days, I made the decision to return to my body, and the internal bleeding stopped. The next concern was whether I would walk again, because I was paralysed from the waist down. They said to my parents the neck break was a stable fracture, but the back was completely crushed. The vertebra at L1 was like you'd dropped a peanut, stepped on it, smashed it into thousands of pieces. They'd have to operate. They went in, they put me on a beanbag, they cut me, literally cut me in half. I have a scar that wraps around my entire body. They picked as much broken bone as they could that had lodged in my spinal cord. They took out two of my broken ribs and they rebuilt my back, L1. They rebuilt it. They took out another broken rib. They fused T12, L1 and L2 together. Then they stitched me up. They took an entire hour to stitch me up. I woke up in intensive care and the doctors were really excited that the operation had been a success, because at that stage I had a little bit of movement in one of my big toes and I thought, great, because I'm going to the Olympics. I had no idea. That's the sort of thing that happens to someone else, not me, surely. But then the doctor came over to me and she said, Janine, the operation was a success and we've picked as much bone out of your spinal cord as we could, but the damage is permanent. They're central nervous system nerves. There is no cure. You're what we call a partial paraplegic and you will have all of the injuries that go along with that. You have no feeling from the waist down, and at most you might get 10 or 20% return. You'll have internal injuries for the rest of your life. You'll have to use a catheter for the rest of your life. And if you walk again, it will be with calipers and a walking frame. And then she said, Janine, you'll have to rethink everything you do in your life, because you're never going to be able to do the things you did before. I tried to grasp what she was saying. I was an athlete, that's all I knew, that's all I'd done. If I couldn't do that, then what could I do? And the question I ask myself is, if I couldn't do that, then who was I? They moved me from intensive care to acute spinal. I was lying on a thin, hard spinal bed. I had no movement in my legs. I had tight stockings on to protect from blood clots. I had one arm in plaster, one arm tied down by drips. I had a neck brace and sandbags on either side of my head. And I saw my world through a mirror that was suspended above my head. I shared the ward with five other people. And the amazing thing is that because we were all lying paralysed in the spinal ward, we didn't know what each other looked like. How amazing is that? How often in life do you get to make friendships judgment-free, purely based on spirit? And there were no superficial conversations as we shared our innermost thoughts, our fears, and our hopes for life after the spinal ward. I remember one night, one of the nurses came in, Jonathan, with a whole lot of plastic straws. He put a pile on top of each of us. And he said, start threading them together. Well, there wasn't much else to do in the spinal ward, so we did. And when we'd finished, he went around silently and he joined all of the straws up till it looped around the whole ward. And then he said, okay, everybody, hold on to your straws. And we did. And he said, right, now we're all connected. And as we held on, and we breathed as one, we knew we weren't on this journey alone. And even lying paralysed in the spinal ward, there were moments of incredible depth and richness, of authenticity and connection that I had never experienced before. And each of us knew that when we left the spinal ward, we would never be the same. After 6 months, it was time to go home. I remember Dad pushing me outside in my wheelchair, wrapped in a plaster body cast, and feeling the sun on my face for the first time. I soaked it up and I thought, how could I ever have taken this for granted? I felt so incredibly grateful for my life. But before I left hospital, the head nurse had said to me, Janine, I want you to be ready, because when you get home, something's going to happen. And I said, what? And she said, you're going to get depressed. And I said, not me, not Janine the Machine, which was my nickname. She said, you are, because see, it happens to everyone. In the spinal ward, that's normal. You're in a wheelchair, that's normal. But you're going to get home and realize how different life is. And I got home and something happened. I realised Sister Sam was right. I did get depressed. I was in my wheelchair. I had no feeling from the waist down, attached to a catheter bottle. I couldn't walk. I'd lost so much weight in hospital, I now weighed about 80 pounds. And I wanted to give up. All I wanted to do was put my running shoes on and run out the door. I wanted my old life back. I wanted my body back. And I can remember Mum sitting on the end of my bed and saying, "I wonder if life will ever be good again." And I thought, how could it? Because I've lost everything that I valued, everything that I'd worked towards, gone. And the question I asked was, why me? Why me? And then I remembered my friends that were still in the spinal ward, particularly Maria. Maria was in a car accident and she woke up on her 16th birthday to the news that she was a complete quadriplegic, had no movement from the neck down, had damage to her vocal cords, and she couldn't talk. They told me, "We're going to move you next to her because we think it will be good for her." I was worried. I didn't know how I'd react being next to her. I knew it would be challenging, but it was actually a blessing because Maria always smiled. She was always happy, and even when she began to talk again, albeit difficult to understand, she never complained, not once. And I wondered, how had she ever found that level of acceptance? And I realised that this wasn't just my life, it was life itself. I realised that this wasn't just my pain, it was everybody's pain. And then I knew, just like before, that I had a choice. I could keep fighting this, or I could let go and accept not only my body, but the circumstances of my life. And then I stopped asking, why me? And I started to ask, why not me? And then I thought to myself, maybe being at rock bottom is actually the perfect place to start. I had never before thought of myself as a creative person. I was an athlete. My body was a machine. But now I was about to embark on the most creative project that any of us could ever do, that of rebuilding a life. And even though I had absolutely no idea what I was going to do, in that uncertainty came a sense of freedom. I was no longer tied to a set path. I was free to explore life's infinite possibilities. And that realization was about to change my life. Sitting at home in my wheelchair and my plaster body cast, an aeroplane flew overhead. And I looked up and I thought to myself, that's it. If I can't walk, then I might as well fly. I said, "Mum, I'm going to learn how to fly." She said, "That's nice, dear." I said, "Pass me the yellow pages." She's passed me the phone book. I rang up the flying school. I made a booking. I said, "I'd like to make a booking to come out for a flight." They said, "When do you want to come out?" I said, "Well, I have to get a friend to drive me out because I can't drive. Sort of can't walk either. Is that a problem?" I made a booking, and weeks later, my friend Chris and my mum drove me out to the airport, all 80 pounds of me covered in a plaster body cast in a baggy pair of overalls. I can tell you, I did not look like the ideal candidate to get a pilot's license. I'm holding onto the counter because I can't stand. I said, "Hi, I'm here for a flying lesson." And they took one look and ran out the back to draw short straws. "You get her." "No, no, you take her." Finally, this guy comes out. He goes, "Hi, I'm Andrew and I'm going to take you flying." I go, "Great." So they drive me down. They get me out on the tarmac and there was this red, white and blue aeroplane. It was beautiful. They lifted me into the cockpit. They had to slide me up on the wing, put me in the cockpit. They sat me down. There are buttons and dials everywhere. I'm going, "Wow, how do you ever know what all these buttons and dials do?" Andrew, the instructor, got in the front, started the aeroplane up. He said, "Would you like to have a go at taxiing? That's when you use your feet to control the rudder pedals, to control the aeroplane on the ground." I said, "No, I can't use my legs." He went, "Oh." I said, "But I can use my hands." And he said, "Okay." So he got over to the runway and he applied the power. And as we took off down the runway and the wheels lifted up off the tarmac and we became airborne, I had the most incredible sense of freedom. And Andrew said to me, as we got over the training area, "You see that mountain over there?" And I said, "Yeah." And he said, "Well, you take the controls and you fly towards that mountain." And as I looked up, I realized that he was pointing towards the Blue Mountains, where the journey had begun. And I took the controls, and I was flying. And I was a long, long way from that spinal ward, and I knew right then that I was going to be a pilot. Didn't know how on earth I'd ever pass a medical. But I'll worry about that later, because right now I had a dream. So I went home, I got a training diary out, and I had a plan. And I practiced my walking as much as I could. And I went from the point of like two people holding me up to one person holding me up, to the point where I could walk around the furniture as long as it wasn't too far apart. And then I made great progression to the point where I could walk around the house holding onto the walls like this. And Mum said she was forever following me, wiping off my fingerprints. But at least she always knew where I was. So while the doctors continued to operate and put my body back together again, I went on with my theory study. And then eventually, and amazingly, I passed my pilot's medical, and that was my green light to fly. And I spent every moment I could out at that flying school, way out of my comfort zone. All these young guys that wanted to be Qantas pilots, you know, and little old hop along me in first my plaster cast and then my steel brace, my baggy overalls, my bag of medication and catheters and my limp. And they used to look at me and think, "Oh, who is she kidding? She's never going to be able to do this." And sometimes I thought that too, but that didn't matter. Because now there was something inside that burned that far outweighed my injuries. And little goals kept me going along the way. And eventually I got my private pilot's license. And then I learned to navigate. And I flew my friends around Australia. And then I learned to fly an aeroplane with two engines. And I got my twin engine rating. And then I learned to fly in bad weather as well as fine weather and got my instrument rating. And then I got my commercial pilot's license. And then I got my instructor rating. And then I found myself back at that same school where I'd gone for that very first flight, teaching other people how to fly. Just under 18 months after I'd left the spinal ward. And then I thought, why stop there? Why not learn to fly upside down? And I did. And I learned to fly upside down and became an aerobatics flying instructor. And Mum and Dad, never been up. But then I knew for certain that although my body might be limited, it was my spirit that was unstoppable. The philosopher Lao Tzu once said, "When you let go of what you are, you become what you might be." I now know that it wasn't until I let go of who I thought I was that I was able to create a completely new life. It wasn't until I let go of the life I thought I should have that I was able to embrace the life that was waiting for me. I now know that my real strength never came from my body. And although my physical capabilities have changed dramatically, who I am is unchanged. The pilot light inside of me was still a light, just as it is in each and every one of us. I know that I'm not my body, and I also know that you're not yours. And then it no longer matters what you look like, where you come from, or what you do for a living. All that matters is that we continue to fan the flame of humanity by living our lives as the ultimate creative expression of who we really are. Because we are all connected. by millions and millions of straws. And it's time to join those up and to hang on. And if we are to move towards our collective bliss, it's time we shed our focus on the physical and instead embrace the virtues of the heart. So raise your straws if you'll join me. Thank you.
I salute you, Janine Shepherd. My metaphorical straw is raised. A remarkable testimony of a personal transformation. And may we all find that spirit when the time comes. And collectively, may we have the determination to hang in there and undergo whatever transformations are necessary. Will it be such a traumatic experience? Hard to say. I guess time will tell. In our second hour, we're going to be looking at our ideas of money, how they need some fundamental revision. And now we're going to turn to the subject of population. This is co-author of the book Too Many People, Ian Angus, speaking this June at the Socialist 2012 conference. And I've edited his talk slightly, entitled The Return of the Population Bombers. If you'd like to download the original, you can do so on this episode's webpage, unwelcomeguests.net/635, or you can go to the site I downloaded the original from, wearemany.org, where they have many such talks from the last few years' socialism conferences, all freely available for download.
On opinion pieces and TV and radio interviews blaming the world's environmental crises on overpopulation. Global warming, loss of biodiversity, deforestation, food and water shortages, all of those problems and many more were blamed on a single cause, too many people. In New York Times Square, members of the Committee to Defend Biodiversity handed out condoms in colorful packages depicting endangered animals, with a huge and very expensive video billboard running above them declaring human overpopulation is driving species extinct. In London, almost every major underground station had an electronic billboard paid for by the Optimum Population Trust declaring that 7 billion people is environmentally unsustainable. Recently, many otherwise responsible scientific groups have joined in promoting the 7 billion scare. In April, Britain's Royal Society, the oldest and most respectable of all scientific societies, published a major report calling for action to reduce birth rates in poor countries. And just 3 weeks ago, the organization that represents the national science academies of 105 countries called on the Rio Plus 20 conference in Brazil to take decisive action to reduce population growth. Populationist ideas are gaining traction in the environmental movement, where a growing number of sincere activists, people who really do want to save the world, are buying into the idea that overpopulation is the cause of the destruction we see around us, and that what's needed is a radical reduction in birth rates. Most of them will say they want voluntary birth control programs, but a growing number are calling for compulsory measures. In his book, The World Without Us, the liberal journalist Ellen Weissman says the only way to save the Earth is, quote, to limit every human female on Earth capable of bearing children to one. Another prominent liberal writer, Chris Hedges, who you may know, writes, all efforts to staunch the effects of climate change are not going to work if we do not practice vigorous population control. A book I saw several copies of over in the Haymarket Center over here, Derek Jensen's Deep Green Resistance, argues for direct action whose purpose, and they say so explicitly, is to reduce the world's population by about 90%. That's billions of people. The famous British naturalist Sir David Attenborough, who you might have seen on PBS specials from time to time, tells us, quote, all environmental problems become harder and ultimately impossible to solve with ever more people. this may seem harmless in its in a way, but you got to know that that Attenborough is the is a patron of the Optimum Population Trust, a very influential British group that uses environmental arguments to argue for stopping immigration. And anti-immigrant organizations in several rich countries, mine, Canada, the United States, and Australia, have adopted the same strategy. In fact, there's a substantial network of organizations in the United States who have adopted green arguments as methods of campaigning for harsh restrictions on immigration. Groups like Californians for Population Stabilization, the Center for Immigration Studies, and the truly misnamed Progressives for Immigration Reform have adopted the same strategy, arguing basically that the only way to save the American environment is by closing the doors. I mean, those people are people who are against immigrants and have tried to figure out a way to use green arguments. But sadly, we're also seeing this from the other side. We're seeing people who actually do care about the environment, who aren't just using green arguments to bash immigrants, adopting that argument. For example, William Rees, who is the co-creator of the concept of the ecological footprint, and a quite fine environmental writer in many ways. He argues that immigration harms the global environment, that is, immigration to rich countries, harms the global environment because the immigrants adopt the wasteful lifestyles of the wealthy countries and thus produce more emissions and so on. He also says that the money that immigrants send home to their families will increase consumption in their home countries and so, quote, contribute to net resource depletion and pollution, both local and global. Now, in effect, what he is saying is that protecting the environment requires potential immigrants to stay home and stay poor. I could go on with many more examples. Population growth is once again being identified as the primary cause of environmental destruction, and population reduction is being identified as the solution, not just by right-wing bigots, although there's a fierce enough problem, but by sincere and confused environmental activists. While I was writing this talk, the magazine Earth Island Journal was running an online poll with the question, can you be a good environmentalist and still have children? The last time I checked, 74% had replied no. Now that's a small it's a small sample, but it's indicative of a whole range of thinking in the green movement right now. That's why Simon Butler and I wrote Too Many People, to provide information and arguments that environmentalists and feminists and socialists can use to respond to the many well-meaning but mistaken activists who have adopted those ideas. I'm not going to repeat all the arguments in Too Many People today. If you haven't read the book, I hope you'll do so. I won't charge for autographing. Well, there's a big thing in the environmental movement about making everything into a commodity, and I was trying to figure out if I could get in on the green economy, but that was less market for that than I imagined. What I want to do in this talk is offer you some historical context and discuss why the overpopulation argument is so effective and so harmful at the same time. Complaints about overpopulation aren't new. Writers have actually been complaining that there are too many people for thousands of years. You can find things in Plato's writing arguing that ancient Greece was overpopulated. But in the modern era, since the French Revolution, the overpopulation argument has played a specific social and ideological role that we don't find in earlier times. In good times, the standard capitalist position is that everything is as good as it can possibly be and everything is getting better. But for over 200 years, whenever people protest the system's massive failure to live up to that promise, the overpopulation argument has been a major fallback position. What it does is provide a biological explanation for a social problem. It allows the powers that be to shift blame for human problems away from society onto individual behavior. Sure, there are problems. We know there are problems. But we can't solve them so long as poor people keep having so many babies. In the 20th century, Overpopulation theory had its greatest impact between World War II and the late 1970s. It began as a response to the revolutionary movements that were sweeping the Third World, and particularly to the Chinese Revolution of 1949. These revolutionary movements blamed capitalism for poverty and hunger and promoted socialism as a solution. But if the poverty of India or China or other countries was actually caused by overpopulation, then communism could be defeated by birth control. It's easy to see why that argument appealed to the rich and powerful. It offered a solution that didn't actually require a change. President Lyndon Johnson said in 1965, less than $5 of investment in population control is worth $100 invested in economic growth. Distributing condoms is a whole lot better than abolishing poverty, effectively. That view became the official foreign policy of most of the wealthy countries in the 1950s, 60s, and 70s. It was implemented directly by northern government aid agencies and indirectly through massive fertility control projects organized and funded by the Rockefeller and Ford foundations. And this has been extensively documented. At the same time, in the 60s and 70s, while overpopulation theory was being used to explain third world poverty, it did double duty as an explanation for the growing environmental crisis. Once again, it provided an explanation and a solution that didn't question capitalism, that diverted people away from effective solutions. Now, I want to stress here, I am not suggesting this was a conspiracy, or that the people who are or the theorists of overpopulation didn't believe what they were saying. I have no question about their sincerity. But they couldn't imagine an alternative to capitalism. They couldn't imagine a different way of doing things. So the problems had to be the result of human beings' failure to behave properly. The first wave of modern environmentalism, really the wave that continues to today, but of the wave that was in the 60s and 70s, was triggered by the publication of Rachel Carson's wonderful book, Silent Spring, in 1962. A book, if you haven't read it, you should. It's not widely remembered today, and the people who praise Rachel Carson rarely mention this. But she was a thinker of the left. Her book focused attention on the crimes of the chemical industry and the complicity of governments. The principal causes of ecological degradation, Carson wrote, were the gods of profit and production. The chief obstacle to sustainability, she wrote, lay in the fact that we live, quote, in an era dominated by industry in which the right to make a dollar at any cost is seldom challenged. She had a social critique of the environmental crisis. And she was not alone in that. In 1962, in a book called Our Synthetic Environment, Murray Bookchin, an author I recommend highly, an anarchist environmentalist, he wrote, "The needs of industrial plants are being placed before man's need for clean air. The disposal of industrial wastes has gained priority over the community's need for clean water. The most pernicious laws of the marketplace are given precedence over the most compelling laws of biology." And in 1966, Barry Commoner, who had played a leading role in exposing the dangers of nuclear fallout, argued that environmentally destructive technologies had become, quote, deeply embedded in our economic, social, and political structure. Carson and Bookchin and Commoner helped to initiate a new kind of environmentalism that was rooted in a social critique. Their analysis was anathema to the traditional conservationists, to the wealthy organizations and individuals who had viewed themselves as the protectors of all things green, whose primary concern was protecting wilderness areas, not changing society, and certainly not protecting human welfare. In 1968, and again, we've got a new movement being born with a social critique. It's new. In 1968, the oldest and the richest of the conservation groups, the Sierra Club, financed the publication, promotion, and wide distribution of a book that was more agreeable to their pro-capitalist views. The Population Bomb, written by Paul and Ann Ehrlich, skipped over and ignored all the social complexities and critiques that had been offered by Carson and Bookchin and Commoner. It contained not one word about... The word corporation does not appear in their books. It skipped over... I actually did a global search. I found a... Just to check that. It did not one word about corporations or industrial policies or markets. Instead, it explained all environmental destruction with just three words. The causal chain of deterioration is easily followed to its source, they wrote. Too many cars, too many factories, too much detergent, too much pesticide, multiplying contrails, inadequate sewage treatment plants, too little water, too much carbon dioxide. All can easily be traced to, strong emphasis, too many people. That's where we got the title, except we put a question mark at the end. The Population Bomb was published in 1968, at the very height of the global radicalization of the 60s, at a time when millions were questioning capitalism and when a significant part of their questioning focused on the ongoing and increasing destruction of the natural world. The book was heavily promoted by the Sierra Club, newspapers and television. Ehrlich himself was interviewed more than 20 times on The Tonight Show, of all things. And liberal Democrats promoted it as an alternative to the radical views of Carson, Commoner, and Bookchin. It became a huge bestseller. It's still one of the best-selling environmental books of all time. And it played a central role in derailing radical environmentalism. The impact of Ehrlich's argument could be seen in the official poster that promoted Earth Day in 1970, the first Earth Day. Its main headline was a sentence from Walt Kelly's comic strip, Pogo: "We have seen the enemy and he is us." It's clever, it's funny, and it says the problem is individual behavior. At a teach-in during that first Earth Day, Barry Commoner strongly condemned and challenged Ehrlich's views. Pollution, he said, begins not in the family bedroom, but in the corporate boardroom. He and others carried through that argument through the 1970s. Commoner's 1971 book, The Closing Circle, is a classic of socialist environmental thought. It's out of print now, but if you can find a copy, it's worth reading. I recommend it highly. But the left lost that battle of ideas. Bookchin described the experience like this some years later. "Based on my own experience as a very active participant in that momentous period, I can say that if there was any single work that aborted a confluence of radical ideas with public environmental concerns, it was Paul Ehrlich's Population Bomb. By the early 1970s, Ehrlich's tract had significantly sidetracked the emerging environmental movement from social critique to a very crude, often odious biologism, the impact of which remains with us today." This transformation happened very quickly. By middle of 1971, the organization Zero Population Growth, which Ehrlich founded, had 36,000 members on U.S. campuses, and making it the largest supposedly progressive organization in the country at the time. Now, it's impossible to say, of course, whether a large-scale anti-capitalist green movement could have been built. That's a historical what-if. But it's very clear that the focus on population diverted the energies of tens of thousands of young greens into harmless channels. Green became synonymous with population control for poor countries and personal behavior change for rich countries. By abandoning the fight for social change, the Green Movement became powerless and irrelevant. In the 1980s, the overpopulation argument seemed to fade away. In part, this was because it was obvious to anybody who read it that Paul Ehrlich's predictions of massive global famine in the 1970s had not come true. And it was also clear that even the largest population control programs had no impact on third world poverty. Population control not only didn't deliver as delivered as promised, but it provoked massive opposition. The defeat of the Gandhi government in India in 1976 was largely the result of a massive revulsion against the compulsory mass sterilizations that took place in India in order to control population in that period. But there was another deeper cause for the decline of populationism in the 80s. Put simply, capitalism didn't need it anymore. The system didn't need it, so it stopped financing it. The mass radicalization of the 60s and 70s was slipping away. The rise of neoliberalism meant that government intervention in economic and social life, including attempts to control birth rates, no longer fit with the direction that the capitalist states and the capitalist economies were moving in. The Reagan government in 1984 declared that population growth was a non-issue. It slashed spending on family planning programs at home and abroad. George H.W. Bush, who had advocated global population control programs in the 1970s, reversed himself when he ran for president in 1988. Population reduction was out of style for the ruling class. But now the bombers are back, reflecting a renewed need for a non-radical explanation of environmental crisis. They aren't yet as influential as they were in the 60s and 70s. But they are growing, and they are being listened to by parts of the ruling class, and most important to us, they are misleading many new green activists. If we're going to win the battle of ideas this time, we need to understand why the overpopulation argument has been so remarkably successful for so long. One important factor is its power as a weapon of those who seek to provoke division among the oppressed and hatred of those who are different. Some of the loudest supporters of population ideas in the United States, Canada, Britain, Australia today are anti-immigrant and racist groups for whom too many people is code for too many foreigners and too many non-white people. But many activists who honestly want to build a better world and are appalled by such racism are attracted by populationist arguments. In our book, Simon and I argue that there are three related factors that make this argument attractive and that we have to confront. The first thing is that populationism actually does identify an important issue. Some writers on the left have tried to refute the populationist argument by claiming that by denying that population growth poses any social, economic, or ecological concerns. Such arguments ignore the simple fact that human beings require sustenance to live, and that unlike other animals, we don't just find our means of life, we use the Earth's resources to make them. For example, in simplest terms, there is a direct relationship between the number of people and the amount of food that's required to sustain those people. That's a fundamental fact of material existence. And no society, capitalist, socialist, or otherwise, can afford to ignore that fact. The populationist error is not that they identify the number of people as an issue. It's that they assume, often without even realizing it, that there is no alternative to the existing society's ways of using resources, or in the case of food, producing and distributing food. So they argue that since modern agriculture is ecologically destructive, which it is, feeding more people will just cause more destruction, so the only ecologically sound approach is to reverse population growth. But as we show in Too Many People, ecologically sound agriculture can actually produce more than enough food to feed the expected population growth in the world today. And in fact, even before a complete transition to ecologically sound agriculture, existing food production is more than enough to feed many more people than there are now on the earth. Just reducing the amount of food that is wasted or misused in rich countries to reasonable levels, we could feed billions more people on the earth today. Somebody points out, if you actually just evenly distributed the amount of food that's currently produced without wasting it, everybody in the world would be obese. So on the one hand, we could feed more people. On the other hand, if population growth is less than many people expect, we could reduce greenhouse gas emissions by reforesting excess farmland. That could be done now. But such changes will require global planning for very long-term use. And capitalism, by its nature, does not engage in global planning. It doesn't think long-term. One of the major tasks that will face a post-capitalist society will be to confront and resolve the gross imbalance that capitalism has created between resources and human needs. And that won't be a one-time task. The relationship between human needs and the resources and ecological services needed to meet them will constantly change, and so the need to monitor and adjust will be constant as well. So we cannot ignore population as a factor in this. Populationists are right that this is an important issue. They're wrong to blame the imbalance between human needs and resources solely or primarily on human numbers. And they're wrong about the measures that are needed to solve it. Number two, second factor in the power of this argument. Populationism is effective because it reduces complex social issues to simple numbers. It takes a lot of thinking to work through some of these issues about agriculture or how you would organize mining or how you deal with resources. But if you can reduce it to numbers, it's easier to, at least apparently easier, to grasp. Thomas Malthus argued in 1798 that the imbalance between people and food is a permanent fact of life because population increases geometrically while subsistence only increases arithmetically. So population goes up 2, 4, 8, 16, whereas the means of subsistence go up 1, 2, 3, 4. Now, he had absolutely no evidence for that claim, and he was dead wrong. But he had shown that the appeal to the immutable laws of mathematics can be very effective. All populationist arguments since then have been rooted in the ideas that our numbers determine our fate, that demography is destiny. Hunger, poverty, and environmental destruction are presented as natural laws. No reasonable person can disagree when math says it's true. But even the best population numbers can't explain the environmental crisis because quantitative measures can't take qualitative issues into effect. Knowing the number of people in a city or a country tells us nothing about the relationships of gender, race, class, oppression, and power that define our connections with each other and with the world. Dr. Lourdes Arispe, a former member of the Mexican Academy of Human Rights and former Assistant General of UNESCO, puts the issue very clearly. She says, "The concept of population as numbers of human bodies is of very limited use in understanding the future of societies in a global context. It is what these bodies do, what they extract and give back to the environment, what use they make of land, trees, and water, and what impact their commerce and industry have on their social and ecological systems that are crucial." And she's dead right. And the third big strength that the populationist argument has is that it promises easy solutions that don't require social change. The world's population, the population explanation seems to offer an easy way out of the world's problems. There's a recent public statement from the Optimum Population Trust in England, which is one of the most active of these groups. And they said, "Providing family planning to everyone who wants it is cheap, effective, and popular with users. It is low-hanging fruit, and much easier than many of the techno fixes and social changes that others are touting. You know, it reminds me of the old joke about the drunk who lost his car keys on First Avenue but was searching for them on Main Street because the light was better there. Only a major social and economic change can save the earth. So focusing on easier birth rates is as pointless as searching where the light is good instead of where you lost your keys. One of the things that makes population reduction seem like an easy solution is that it puts the burden of action on other people. The Australian socialist Adam Roberts wrote about the previous wave of... Excuse me, it's not Adam Roberts. I'll come back to that. I've got the wrong name in here for unknown reasons. Anyway, he wrote about the previous wave of population over 30 years ago. And he said, it was only too evident that when an ecologist, a population theorist, or an economist voiced his alarm of the plague of too many people, he was not really complaining that there existed too many ecologists, too many population theorists, or too many economists. The surplus obviously consisted of less essential categories of the population. As Simon and I say in our book, for many, too many people is code for too many poor people, too many foreigners, too many people of color. But we have to take that into account, the belief it's an easy solution. Because it separates population growth from the historical, social, and economic context, the population explanation boils down to big is bad and bigger is worse. When you really dig through the words, that's the argument. And its solutions are just as simplistic. 200 years ago, the radical essayist William Hazlitt identified the fundamental flaw in Malthus's theory that population growth made poverty inevitable. Malthus, Hazlitt wrote, viewed the specific social problems and structures of his time as laws of nature. And I'll quote, Hazlitt's mostly forgotten today, but he was a wonderful writer. He says, Mr. Malthus wishes to confound the necessary limits of the produce of the earth with the arbitrary and artificial distribution that produce of that produce according to the institutions of society and or the caprice of individuals. He said, Malthus confuses the laws of God with the laws of nature. He confuses the laws of God and nature with the laws of man. You blow your punchline if you misquote. Okay. Modern populationists are more likely to justify the too many people argument by reference to the laws of thermodynamics than to the laws of God. But Hazlitt's criticism still applies. The capitalist system is grossly inefficient. It's inequitable and wasteful. It cannot create without destroying. It cannot survive without mindlessly devouring ever more human and natural resources. Blaming shortages of food and overuse of resources on human numbers confuses sociology with biology. In Hazlitt's words, it treats the institutions of society as laws of God. Populationist responses to environmental problems search for solutions within a system that is inherently hostile to any solution. Recognition that the system itself is the problem leads to a different approach. The pursuit of an ecological revolution that will refashion the economy and society, restore and maintain the integrity of ecosystems, and improve human welfare. In Too Many People, Simon and I argue that the fundamental cause of environmental destruction is an economy in which the need to reduce costs and increase profits takes precedence over everything else, including human survival. Universal access to birth control and abortion should be a fundamental human right. And we defend that absolutely. But it would not have prevented Shell's massive destruction of ecosystems in the Niger River Delta. It would not have halted or even slowed the immeasurable damage that Chevron has caused to the rainforests of Ecuador. If the birth rate in Iraq or Afghanistan fell to zero today, the U.S. military, which is the world's largest polluter, would not use one less gallon of oil. If every African country adopted a one-child policy yesterday, energy companies in the U.S., China, Canada, and elsewhere will continue burning coal, bringing us ever closer to climate catastrophe. The too many people argument directs the attention and the efforts of sincere activists to programs that will not have any meaningful effect on the environment, but that can be very harmful to human rights. And the evidence of this is overwhelming. As I say, we fully support access, universal access to birth control and abortion. But when that is motivated and promoted and financed by the goal of reducing population, again and again, the result has been vile and violent attacks on the human rights, and particularly the rights of women in the third world. We can trace back to the experience of Puerto Rico, where sterilization became pretty much a condition of getting a job, through to India, through to Peru in the 1990s, where an estimated 200,000 indigenous women were forcibly sterilized. Continuing to today, when just in the last couple of months there have been stories coming out of India of compulsory sterilization programs because the birth control agencies are given quotas. So instead of being treated as a right to choose, it becomes mandatory. Such programs weaken our efforts to build an effective global movement against ecological destruction. It divides our forces. By blaming the principal victims of the crisis for problems they did not cause. And above all, it ignores the massively destructive role of an irrational economic and social system that has gross waste and devastation built into its DNA. The capitalist system and the power of the 1%, not population size, are the root causes of today's ecological crisis. As Barry Commoner said, pollution begins not in the family bedroom, but in the corporate boardroom. That's the central message of our book. Unless we transform the economy and our society along sustainable lines, we have no hope of securing a habitable planet, regardless of the number of people there are. Barry Commoner also said that trying to fix the environment by reducing population is like trying to repair a leaky ship by throwing passengers overboard. Instead, he said, we should ask if there isn't something radically wrong with the ship. That's the question Simon and I tried to address in Too Many People. We hope you find it a useful weapon in the battle of ideas. Thank you.